Everybody seemed so jubilant that we were closing a chapter in a really bad time in our lives. They were so happy.
Melissa DeBoer can finally exhale because Rodney Lincoln has been sentenced to 2 life terms plus 15 years. He's been convicted for the murder of her mother, Joanne Tate, and the vicious attacks on her and her little sister.
I knew my family was ready to move on, so I kept going, but I was always scared. I was always looking in, like, the alleys and the shadows and around the corners. I couldn't put into words why.
I'm Leah Rothman. This is The Real Killer, Episode 4, Life Imprisoned.
Starting route to 1418 Farrar Street. Proceed to Rutger Street, then turn right.
If at any point we're driving around and you don't feel comfortable, you gotta tell me, okay?
I will. Okay. Make a left if it lets you. Because that's my school. Yeah, good. Oh, goodness.
So this is your school?
Yep, this was my school. And God, they have not changed the fence. This was right here where, like, our classes came out down here to come out for recess. Over on that side was where a girl punched me in the stomach for kissing her brother on the cheek. Oh God, this is so eerie. Oh my God, yeah. We would walk through this path I walked out with my mom.
What does it feel like to be back in this neighborhood?
Like, I'm with my mom and my family. Like, they've never left.
That's Melissa DeBoer today. With her permission, she's showing me around her old neighborhood of Hyde Park on the north side of St. Louis.
I'll show you where my grandma lived. Oh my gosh, can you make a right? Oh my goodness. We're on Mallinckrodt right now. My Aunt Abby and my grandma lived on this street. At one time, this house with the blue trim on the brick, mm-hmm. like the grayish trim, mm-hmm. that's my grandma's house.
And then, is that the church?
That's Holy Trinity Catholic Church, yes. Okay, you're gonna go up here and make a right. That's the alley where my house was. Yep, that's the alley.
Do you feel comfortable?
Yeah.
Do you wanna?
Yeah, let's do it. This is the alley. And our house was right here. Let me see here. Yep. They tore my house down. It was right here. This is where the house was. Yeah, they tore it. The house was right here. Yep, I remember this. I have dreams about this right here.
What kind of dreams?
Like, that I'm walking with my mom and my grandma, and we're going down there for a church fair.
It seems like everything you needed was right in your neighborhood.
It was so close.
Your family, your mm-hmm. school, your church.
And it was ripped away.
Back in 1983, Melissa is 8 years old. Her mom is gone, the trials are over, and dealing with the aftermath isn't easy, especially at school.
I have a colostomy bag because my colon, my anus, none of that was working. It was awful. The colostomy bag poked out underneath my clothes. Sometimes I smelled. I was still very traumatized. The teachers didn't really know how to deal with it. I felt very isolated.
How was Renee?
Renee was very quiet. But when she wasn't quiet, she was prone to rage and fits. Renee tended to lash out, where I tended to turn my anger inward.
But there is some joy in their world. Their aunt, Rachel Clenny.
My Aunt Rachel was my favorite aunt. She was a sunny, fun personality. She was artsy. She was an adventurer, loved to travel. She was a photographer. And she indulged me, like, in my passions and whims. And she got us when Mama died. And Aunt Rachel, it seemed like life had the possibility of being normal with her.
So you and Renee go and live with Aunt Rachel.
And her husband, a man she met and married just for us, to get custody of us. They wouldn't give us to her if she were single.
A man the girls do not like. And then Rachel seems to change after having her first child.
I went from seeing my happy aunt, my fun aunt, to someone that had a lot of migraines and someone who would lose her temper really quickly, very moody.
A couple of years later, and a couple of months after Rachel has her second child, tragedy strikes their family again. Rachel has a cerebral hemorrhage. Melissa and Renee are not prepared for what Rachel's husband tells them when they arrive at the hospital.
I see my Aunt Rachel hooked up to all these machines. She's not moving. And he said, take a look at her, because you two did this to her. You two killed her. You drove her so crazy, her brain blew up. And I believed him. And Renee just couldn't understand. She's like, I did what?
The girls lose their Aunt Rachel 5 years after losing their mom.
And then a month later, a few days after my birthday, my uncle married this young woman. And that's when he started abusing me and my sister.
For 3 years, Melissa says she is sexually and physically abused by her uncle, Rachel's husband. But she says it's the mental abuse that's almost harder to endure.
He brainwashed both of us to think that we were worthless and stupid and inherently evil, doomed people, just flawed and worthless and hangers-on. One day he accused me of doing something I did not do, and he slapped me across the face, full open hand, and he said, get out of my house. And he took his wife and his kids and left me and Renee at the house. And the moment he left, I told Renee, pack a bag, we're getting out of here.
The girls, now 15 and 13, bounce around to other family members before Uncle Nat and Aunt Lori agree to take them in.
Living with Uncle Nat and Aunt Lori was so much fun.
This is Melissa cleaning a room once in a lifetime.
Hey, Melissa! You cleaning your room?
God, this is once in a lifetime. Look at this, Renee. Oh my God. She cleaned the floor.
I was allowed to wear hairspray and use eyeliner and be a typical teenager. I had never felt so free. Not only that, they indulged my music love. Suede fringe jacket, heavy metal. I went from having zero freedom. I couldn't even sit next to a boy on the bus, to being trusted and given the freedom to be who I was. They were young people who had never had any kids. A lot of trial and error.
Here are Nat and Lori again.
Lori and I were just kids ourselves.
Remember, Nat and Lori are only 10 years older than Melissa.
At first, it was okay. We didn't have a lot of trouble out of Renee, but Melissa, it seemed like she was just disrespecting Lori. It seemed like it just got worse.
Like Nat put it to me, he said, Melissa was like a caged lion. She wasn't allowed to go anywhere, have any friend, school and home, that was it. Well, when she came to live with us,
She got her freedom.
And it, you know, you let a cat out of a cage, it's going to go everywhere and want to do everything and be very rebellious. Well, and along with being 15, you know it all. Nobody can tell you anything.
Things get worse from there, and after a year and a half, they ask Melissa to leave.
I can't really blame him. With kids that are traumatized, you can only deal with so much. We really didn't come with a handbook. So Renee went to live with Abby, and I went to live with my older sister. And then it seemed like from then on, I couldn't really see Renee that often.
It's so heartbreaking to think that you lose your mom, you lose your second mom, and Rachel, and then you're separated by the person who shared.
We shared everything. I never had to explain anything to Renee. We were polar opposites, but we understood. Just over and over again, I thought I'd landed in a safe place. There was no safe place because there was like a war in my head.
At 19, on a whim, Melissa enrolls in the Navy and is sent to the Naval Training Center in San Diego. A world away and a welcomed escape from St. Louis and all the trauma of her past. It turns out to be her best decision yet. And it's in this new life she finds something she's really good at.
It was a merge of information technology and intelligence. I picked up the information technology easily. I picked up secrecy easily because I had learned early in my life keep things to myself.
And Melissa finds something else. Love, with a naval officer fresh out of boot camp. After dating only a couple of months, they marry, and a year and a half later, welcome a daughter, Jackie. But in 1999, they divorce. Melissa and her daughter move back to St. Louis, and she gets a job with a contractor for the Department of Defense.
The clearance that I was required to have was top secret and above, and I had an above top secret clearance. I was more successful than I'd ever been. I had proven a lot of people wrong about what I could do. But that's when my PTSD showed its first symptoms. Depression, severe anxiety, always watching behind my back. I didn't feel safe. I started to have really severe episodes of sleeping problems where I was hallucinating what I dreamed about. I was waking up, putting my daughter in the bathtub because I thought a tornado was coming. I called the police in my sleep because I thought a burglar was trying to get in. But it was turning into something very dangerous because my brain could not discern reality from my dream. I was running from scary people and in fear of my life.
Rodney Lincoln goes into prison, a 38-year-old man. He'll start serving his time at the Missouri State Penitentiary, also known as the Walls.
At that time, it was known as the bloodiest 47 acres in America, and they lived up to their name.
Although Rodney's been incarcerated before, this time is very different.
First 10 years was rough. With the case I had, I was an immediate outcast.
Because you'd been convicted of hurting children.
I was a child molester. People didn't want to associate with me, didn't want to talk to me. A lot of them wanted to hurt me.
Were you physically threatened? Often?
Many times. Physically attacked several times. I can honestly say that I've never taken the life of anyone in prison. But there was times when I had to leave scars. I got to the point where I decided either I was going to let him kill me, I was going to fight back. I chose to fight back.
Let me ask you, when you first came in, did you feel like you needed to join any group to stay protected?
I was rejected by those groups. Because
what group would have you? It would have been like the white Aryan nation, right?
Right. And you know what they hate more than anything? Child molesters.
While Rodney fights day in and day out to stay alive on the inside, it's who's on the outside that gives him the strength to keep going. His family, especially his daughter, Kay.
My dad, even after he was arrested, after he was imprisoned 200 miles away behind brick walls, was still an effective parent. I was 13 years old when he was arrested, and we still maintained the same relationship that we did before he left. I wrote to him. If I had a problem, I talked to my dad about it. If I needed advice, I asked my dad for it. You think you can get anything by old dad? Well, no. He's still going to be a parent when he needs to be, you know, have that strict hand. When I was 16 years old, I ran away from home. And the first thing my mom did was write a letter to my dad. I wrote him and told him where I was. He wrote me back and he said, I'm not going to tell you you have to go home, but you have to call your mom and let her know you're okay. And I was like, okay. My dad was always a very heavy presence in my life, even when he couldn't physically be there.
Do you have any of the letters that your dad wrote you while in prison?
I do. Let's see. Here's one. Yeah, this was from May of 1985, and in it he says, Honey, I miss you too. Hopefully I will be able to get out of this mess within a few years, and I will try to be a better father in the future than I have in the past. 1985.
What do you think when you read that?
It pisses me off. Now, this is a later one. Dearest Kay, hi, honey. Just a few words to say hello. Kay, I often tell you I love you, and I truly do, but what I don't tell you nearly enough is thank you. Thank you for being such a caring and loving person. Thank you for being the daughter that makes me the proudest father in the world. Thank you for believing in me when it was unbelievably hard. Thank you for loving me. What kind of world does a dad have to thank his daughter for believing in him? My dad never lied to me in all my life. I mean, he may have told me some things that I didn't want to hear, but he didn't lie. And for him to say he didn't do it, I never questioned it. I never once had the thought, well, maybe he did do it.
But Kay's younger sister, Kelly, wasn't always as sure.
There was one point in my teenage years, after all of his appeals had been done, well, did he? Could he? And I think that was just me wanting to distance myself from it. And I don't think I ever really thought he did it, but there was one point where I was questioning it. And it wasn't so much about him, it was, if he did do it, am I capable of doing that? Because I'm his daughter. There were times that I didn't want him to be my dad, and I would even pretend that he wasn't. If people would bring up, oh, that's not my dad. I remember I was angry at my dad because he left. Even though it wasn't his choice, I didn't quite understand that. And so I was mad at him.
Did he know you were mad at him?
I don't know if he actually knew I was mad at him. I know that he knew I had a lot of confusion about it. And for a long time, I really didn't have a relationship with him. I mean, when he would call, like, on holidays and the phone got passed around, I would talk to him, but it was always very superficial. You know, yeah, I'm doing good. How are you? Yeah, I love you. I love you too. You know, but I never made a point to reach out to him, even though he still continued to reach out to me all the time. He would write me letters, get no response back. And that went on for over a decade.
Beginning in 1991, then every 5 years after, Rodney goes up for parole. He's denied every time.
So time is going by, right? And Have you resigned yourself to the fact that this is going to be the rest of your life?
One of the questions that I was asking HR is, have you ever thought about suicide? I told the guy, I think anybody with heavy time has. He said, have you? I said, I got heavy time. He said, do you feel suicidal? I said, you know, if nobody in this world loves me, I do. Besides, my focus was I had to fit up with it until I get out.
Then, on June 5th, 2003, 21 years after Joanne's murder, an announcement from the St. Louis Circuit Attorney's Office on the evening news. The elected circuit attorney, Jennifer Joyce, has started a justice project, basically a conviction integrity unit, which will be led by assistant circuit attorney, Ed Pistacco. Of the 1,400 cases they've been looking at where innocence or guilt could be proven with a DNA review, they've narrowed the 1,400 down to 6. That evening, Kay goes to her mom's house.
I walk in my mom's door and she goes, your dad may be home soon. They just showed his picture on the news and said that they're doing a DNA review and they're reviewing 6 cases and his is one of them. I said, Mom, you're crazy. I said, they're never gonna let him out. A week later, on June 12th, I'm at work and I just had this really uneasy feeling all evening, just didn't know what it was. And when I left work, I look at my phone and I've got phone calls and text messages. I'm like, what is going on? Melissa had been on the news and she contacted them and they went and interviewed her. And she said, I don't need a DNA review. I know it was him.
Melissa goes public with her strong opposition to the review. But Kay's not about to let her be the only voice out there. So she reaches out to the same station, and the following week, Rodney and Kay are interviewed. This does not sit well with Melissa. That very same day, Melissa puts pen to paper.
I wanted to make sure that Rodney could not move about the prison with freedom. So I wrote a letter to him, and I wrote all his charges all over the exterior of this envelope. I knew it would be seen by the mailroom personnel. I knew it passed through several hands. People talk.
What did you write?
Oh God, I wrote baby rapist. I wrote woman killer. I wrote predator. And it covered the whole envelope. I wanted to make sure Rodney never felt a day's peace because I didn't. I wanted him to look over his shoulder and look at people like with a suspicious eye. I really felt that he needed to know the life that I knew.
Did you want harm to come to him?
I didn't want it to come, but I wasn't opposed to it.
And Melissa doesn't stop there.
I was so angry and resentful. I went after his daughter and the media. I said that Kay was very impressionable, that she was misinformed, that she was gullible, and she was a fool. It was a nice little assortment of words to imply that she had reduced intelligence and a lack of critical thinking. It was ruthless. I was very adamant that Rodney killed my mom, that he tried to kill me and my sister, and I was mad that anybody questioned my judgment.
On April 4th, 2004, Assistant Circuit Attorney Ed Pistacco, who had been leading the review of Rodney's case, says there's no relevant evidence that would provide conclusive proof of innocence or guilt. The fingernail scrapings could not be located, and the hair found on the blanket, which was used at trial to convict Rodney, well, now they say it doesn't provide conclusive proof of anything. Kay has questions, lots of questions. Forget the fact that they closed the review. If they thought that her dad's case was worthy of a review in the first place, there must be something there. And now she wants to review the case herself. But out of the gate, Kay hits a brick wall.
It started out by them telling me they couldn't find the transcripts.
Transcripts from the first trial, that is. So she gets the transcripts from the second trial and dives right in.
I was just so taken aback and so shocked by what I was reading. And the more I read, the more I want. So I'm like, okay, I need the police reports. So I requested the police reports. I read these police reports and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. And then I'm like, okay, I need more information. I want this lineup photo. And I saw that lineup photo. And I was just like, you've got to be kidding me. And then I read that there were depositions being taken. So I'm like, well, I don't have depositions. I need depositions. So I went back to the court. And every time I'd get something new, I'd find something else that didn't add up. Like, how can they do this? And I honestly just kept digging. I spent entire days at the library pulling up old newspapers on microfilm and reading the news reports. And I would take a notebook and I'd see a name and I'd write it down. And then I'd go do people searches and try to find these people. And I knew nothing about investigating. I knew nothing about researching. I winged it. And you dig. You dig. And you keep doing whatever it takes to find the information you need to have. I had amassed so much information and so much evidence that I never was privy to before that I was just dumbfounded by the things I had found.
Things like what had been going on with Rodney's defense attorney, Robert Hampe.
In between the first trial ending and the second trial starting, Robert Hampe was being investigated himself for his participation in a money laundering scheme. And the person who he was in business with had actually decided to cooperate with the police. And the very day that my dad's second trial started, this person who was cooperating and was planning to testify against Robert Hampe was found murdered in Illinois. So he had that whole thing going on at the same time that he was defending my father in court. He was being investigated.
Armed with thousands of pages of police reports, trial transcripts, and depositions, Kay makes a promise she intends to keep.
I told Ed Pistocco, this isn't over. I'm not done. And I set out to find somebody who knew about wrongful convictions. So I just started looking for lawyers and researching wrongful convictions in Missouri and reading about different wrongful convictions that had been turned over or that were being litigated. And I kept seeing the name Steve Weinberg. Steve Weinberg, Steve Weinberg, Steve Weinberg, Steve Weinberg. So who is the Steve Weinberg?
Steve Weinberg's resume is extensive and impressive. But if I have to reduce it down to one sentence, here goes. He's an accomplished investigative journalist, author of 10 books and dozens of major magazine articles, emeritus professor of journalism at the University of Missouri, former executive director of the Investigative Reporters and Editors Nonprofit Organization, and the founder of the Midwest Innocence Project. And this is my biased opinion. Maybe it's because I was a journalism major, but Steve and his work at the University of Missouri, one of the best journalism schools in the country, makes him, to me, a bit of a rock star. I interviewed him at his home in Columbia, Missouri. Before we talk about Kay Lincoln, I want to learn how Steve first became interested in investigating wrongful convictions.
So during the decades that I ran Investigative Reporters and Editors, the main part of my job was to consult with other journalists who would contact me for help on how to go about this or how to go about that. And until I started hearing from journalists all around the country all the time, I wasn't particularly aware of the whole phenomenon of wrongful convictions. And even those who were aware before I was often got met with skepticism, because until DNA testing started becoming reliable and widespread in the late 1980s, a lot of people, you know, had no proof that there were a lot of wrongful convictions. So I became really interested in the whole wrongful conviction phenomenon and began to do some of the work myself on individual cases. And so before I heard from Kay Lincoln, I was deeply into wrongful conviction stuff.
And when Steve receives Kay's email, he immediately recognizes something different.
Well, as you may have intuited, lots of times when journalists or others hear from loved ones of someone they think is innocent, the people who are doing the contacting are very emotional and not very well organized in their thinking or in whatever paperwork might exist. But Kay was different. I mean, I didn't know at the time that she had almost no formal education. She dropped out of high school. But I could just tell she was different from people I usually heard from, that she was not unemotional, but realistic and very well organized with her documentation. I was teaching an investigative reporting class, and I thought, you know, after I meet with Kay, if this looks like a promising case where I can really be of some use, then I can get the students involved for a whole semester for academic credit. And that's what happened.
They start with looking at the initial investigation and Detective Joe Burgoon.
Well, right after the murder, Burgoon was on vacation. So for the first few weeks, he was out of the loop, and the other cops were just flailing. They had no idea. And of course, there was a lot of pressure on them to solve this case. Understandable. It was an extremely emotional murder, and then the mutilation of these two girls. And so when Burgoon got back from vacation and took over the investigation, he was very emotional in his own right, because he really wanted to solve the case, and I admire him for that, of course. I'll tell you an anecdote jumping forward, but when I and the students interviewed Burgoon, he actually willingly came from St. Louis to Columbia and talked to the class, which was pretty amazing, I thought. Most cops never would have done that, because we were basically second-guessing him. But the day he came to Columbia to talk to the class, and he pulled out his wallet at one point. This is in 2005, 23 years after the murder and the mutilation of those girls, and he still had their pictures from 1982 that he carried around in his wallet because he got so emotionally involved in that case. So that says a lot. Burgoon, on the slimmest of evidence, I'm not even sure the word evidence is right, jumped to some wrong conclusions that sealed Rodney Lincoln's fate. As soon as they made a link to Rodney Lincoln, which was so ridiculously slim in the first place, they stopped paying attention to any contradictory evidence, in my opinion.
Were there viable suspects?
Yes, lots of them. The murder victim, let's just say, was always looking for love in all the wrong places. And she had so many former husbands, so many former lovers. Some of them had alibis, but in my opinion, the police didn't take any of those possible suspects seriously after Rodney Lincoln's name came up in the weirdest way. They just shut down.
I actually asked Detective Joe Burgoon about that when we spoke. There were people that seemed like they could have been suspects, right? Viable suspects. Did, was how, like, what kind of investigation was done into them?
I think they showed the pictures to him, you know. During that week I was off when this investigation started, they showed all these pictures, I guess. They didn't pick on anybody, you know, and so that's why we wanted to start fresh. We didn't want to show any pictures or anything. We didn't want to confuse them. Because they were getting, you know, a lot of pressure from their aunts and their uncles and that, you know, hollering at them and things like that, you know, what happened.
I gotta say, I give Joe Burgoon credit for talking to me, but sometimes it seems like he isn't fully answering the question. Like, I just asked if any of the viable suspects were properly investigated, and he answers by saying Melissa and Renee didn't pick out anyone from the photos they were shown. Then he goes on to say he didn't show any photos to the girls because he didn't want to confuse them. But based on his own police reports, he did, in fact, show Melissa photos of suspects on at least two occasions. So, sometimes he doesn't really answer the question, and sometimes he contradicts his own police reports. I wonder, is it because so many years have gone by and his memory is fuzzy, or is it a bit of a rewriting of history? Once you had Rodney, did the investigation continue, or was it still just based on Rodney?
There was 37 pictures shown, all bills. You know, and she didn't pick out any of them. We had to go out and we had to get 37 pubic hair samples from all the guys that were, so we could, you know, we thought that, they eliminated them against the hair they found, you know, but that took a while to get hold of all these guys.
Steve and his students learned that the way the composite sketch came to be was highly unusual. Cops started with a photo of a family friend who, at one point, Melissa said resembled a killer, and they went from there.
Well, what happened was the police artist had the photograph and showed it to Melissa and said, did the eyes of the person who killed your mom look like this or this? Or the mouth look like this or this?
From that, they get the composite sketch. And only when police go through Joanne's diary with her family do they land on Rodney.
What did you make of the lineup?
Oh, the lineup was absurd. And what else can you say? So obviously weighted toward Rodney Lincoln.
I'm going to describe the lineup from what's written in the police report and from the photo, which I'm looking at right now. There are four white males in this lineup. I'll get to Rodney in a minute. First, the other three men. Two of them are 21 years old, one is 18. All have lighter and longer hair. Two of the men have mustaches. Rodney is 37 years old. He has dark brown hair, cut short, no mustache, and he's inches shorter than the other men. Although the police report says that they're all 5'7", not even remotely possible. It's one of those times during this process I wish it wasn't just audio and I could show you the actual lineup photo. Objectively speaking, it's kind of crazy. Here's Detective Burgoon again.
There was a few mistakes, I think. You try and get them as the same weight, height, things, similar descriptions, you know, if they're there. It was on a Saturday. And there aren't too many people locked up, and then you deal with white males, you know, and trying to find, it's hard to find white males. We used to try, have to use police officers, you know, but there was shift change and everything else, so that didn't work out. You know, so we had to work deal with the best we could. But Rachel was there for all that, too.
If you do a lineup and then there's nobody that looks like your suspect, don't you wait until you can get people who...
We can't. When we bring somebody in, if we're going to arrest them, we don't, at Missouri at that time, they had 20 hours. You have 20 hours to apply for warrants. And that's the problem.
So you felt like you had only 20 hours in order for there to be a...
Well, that's when we had 20 hours to charge him. You know, we could always go back and as long as he hasn't been found guilty or not guilty in court, you know, but we have 20 hours to make it. Once we take somebody to custody, we have 20 hours to hold the case.
Back to Steve Weinberg.
When police got a search warrant and searched the car, his mom's car, did they find any evidence?
There was zero physical evidence.
His mother's car was the one Rodney drove, and it was a 1972 Pontiac Catalina light green station wagon. Not a yellow taxi or a white Volkswagen, like Melissa said Bill drove.
So the trials. There doesn't seem to be a transcript for the first trial.
The transcript is missing. My students and I even found the transcriptionist who had retired and moved away. And she, I don't know if she had dementia by the time we reached her, but she was no help at all. So we had to do our best piecing information from the first trial from other documents that mentioned the hung jury. But we know now, with an almost 100% degree of certainty, that there were five jurors who wanted to vote not guilty. And so it was a hung jury.
Steve's students talked with some of those jurors. I was able to talk with one, too.
My name is Marianne Widus, and I was on the jury for his first trial.
Mary was in her early 30s at the time of the trial. Today, she's 72. Besides being sequestered and reporting another juror for misconduct, which actually resulted in that woman being kicked off the jury, the most telling and compelling moment of the trial is the first time she sees young Melissa.
Melissa came into the courtroom and she saw Rodney at his table. She smiled so big when she saw Rodney and started walking over there. The DA grabbed her hand and walked her up to the stand.
What did you make of that moment, Melissa walking towards Rodney?
For me, it was like she didn't think anything wrong with Rodney. She was not holding anything against him. I felt that she, it's hard to explain. It's like, for me, it was like a point where if this really did happen the way the DA is saying, why would she go over and smile at someone who has been reported as hurting her and her sister and murdering her mother?
How was Melissa on the stand?
The DA had to kind of remind Melissa of things and say, well, you told me this in the hospital. Is that what you said? We talked about this at the hospital when I talked to you. Don't you remember? And it was kind of, to me, felt like he was leading her to answer the way he wanted and not the way she wanted. Hmm. Or she would have said, you know?
Was there one person's testimony in particular that had a major effect on you?
I guess I would say Burgoon. Burgoon just, he gave the impression that what I say goes. I am, you know, because of his position and who he was, and that arrogant, very arrogant, the way he was on the stand. And I didn't like that. It seemed like he was trying to say, I am right, this is right, this is how it went, this is what we found, and so this is Rodney. We have to put him in prison. I will tell you personally myself, I don't know what anybody else did, but I know I never prayed more in my life than I did during that trial. Because I kept saying to God, please show me, make sure, show me what I should vote. Because right now I don't see much saying it's Rodney. But if he is the one, Make sure I know it.
What was it like during those deliberations?
There were two of us that felt Rodney was innocent. And the rest said he was guilty. They got very heated in our jury, yeah. They were very heated. Why can't we change our mind, you know? And all the other guy and I kept saying, prove it, prove it, prove it. And by the time we left, we had pulled one or two over to our side because of what we had said about why we felt and what wasn't shown to us to prove that it was actually him.
What did you think when you learned that Rodney had been found guilty in the second trial?
I was upset. I felt bad about the trial. I felt bad about what the decision was.
Back to Steve Weinberg. After a semester of Steve and his students researching, tracking down people and documents, and analyzing everything they had compiled, Steve sits down to write a feature article based on their investigation. His 11 students make any necessary corrections or clarifications. All will get byline credit. 11 months after Kay Lincoln first reached out to Steve, and 23 years into her father's prison sentence, on October 23, 2005, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch runs their story, The Aftermath of Murder, on the front page of the Sunday edition. The best circulation at the time.
What happens? The article is published, and what happens next?
Well, I'm not sure how much of an influence our article had. I think it certainly raised the consciousness of many, many people in St. Louis about this case. But did we solve anything with 100% certainty? No.
While that article may not have moved the needle, that makes no difference to Melissa DeBoer.
It was a war. I went to war.
Next time on The Real Killer.
My God, you know, how does this happen?
St. Louis Metro PD's case is under the microscope.
We found 9 of her fingernails, an ashtray full of cigarette butts, and found a pair of underwear.
What did you do with that?
We threw it all away because they said they were done.
And a bombshell. Some never-disclosed evidence is accidentally uncovered.
I think that's when I knew that I'd hit something big.
The Real Killer is a production of AYR Media and iHeartRadio, hosted by me, Leah Rothman. Executive producers Leah Rothman and Aliza Rosen for AYR Media. Written by me, Leah Rothman. Senior Associate Producer, Eric Newman. Editing and Sound Design by Cameron Taggy. Mixed and Mastered by Cameron Taggy. Audio Engineering by Jesus C. Murillo. Studio Engineering by Tom Weir and Kelly McGrew. Legal Counsel for AYR Media, Gianni Douglas. Executive Producer for iHeartRadio, Chandler Mays. If you're enjoying The Real Killer, tell your friends about it and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.